Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Doctor's Kitchen. Recipes, health, lifestyle.
There's a scene where, briefly, where I am protested by some vegan activists, and there's a sign that it says something along the lines of Brian Caitman speaking at an animal rights conference is like Donald Trump speaking at a women's rights conference. So there's a lot baked in there. But I felt like, you know, I'm on your team.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast. Show about food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. I'm Dr. Rupi, your host. I'm a medical doctor, I study nutrition, and I'm a firm believer in the power of food and lifestyle as medicine. Join me and my expert guests where we discuss the multiple determinants of what allows you to lead your best life. Finally, I can say I watched a genuinely balanced documentary about the food and the environment. I've seen all the classics, What the Health, Forks Over Knives, Game Changers, Food Inc., Seaspiracy, and others like Kiss the Ground. And I'm constantly asked about it on social media and by friends. The conversation usually goes like this. Did you see insert documentary name? What did you think? And invariably, I always have to point out the flaws, biases, the shock tactics, the spin. But this documentary is refreshingly different. Meet me halfway. Meat as in meat, animal meat. Produced by my guest today, Brian Caitman. And it's a documentary about finding common ground at the dinner table. It poses more questions than answers, and it allows you to make your own mind up. It doesn't have a clear ideology woven through the narrative, and it's more exploratory than it is explanatory or defensive. And when I was watching the movie, I made notes to pick up on with Brian when I knew I was going to interview him, the documentary host, about it. But a little later in the movie, they discussed the nuance of that very topic. I didn't have many follow-up questions to the answers they posed at the end of the movie because there weren't that many answers. And that's because this is super complicated. And the conversation that we're having within our own avocado toast eating echo chambers centers around idealism rather than practicality. And this is why I thought this documentary was particularly great. Brian is also co-founder and president of the Reducetarian Foundation, a non-profit organization dedicated to reducing consumption of meat, eggs, and dairy to create a healthy, sustainable, and compassionate world. The Meet Me Halfway book is out next year, and the Reducetarian Cookbook is available already in good bookstores. And listen to the end where I reveal my favorite meat alternatives and hacks to reduce your meat consumption whilst maintaining a nutrient-dense diet. And you can find all the links to the movies at thedoctorskitchen.com, where you can also sign up to our weekly newsletter. I think you're going to really enjoy this conversation. So on to the pod. I would have never have understood the love for a puppy until I got mine last year in April, I think it was, when we got little Nutmeg. And I was never a dog person, right? Never a dog person. I mean, my best friend had a puppy and he's got a picture just like that in his office, in like blown up, like full size. And I remember going to his office one day. He used to live in Miami. I'm going to his office. I was like, don't people think you just look ridiculous with this massive puppy on your, and you're at work and you're people's boss, you know? And now I'm like looking at those puppy pictures. I'm like, I need to get one of mine and like mine and put mine behind the on the wall here.
It does look, it looks awesome. A little bit like a shrine, but once you fall in love with a companion animal, you start to get it. And by the way, Nutmeg is a very cute name. That's awesome, Nutmeg.
Yeah, she's gorgeous as well. She's a Cavapoo. She just never grew. So she's actually yay big, even though she's like 20 months now. She should be like 3 times the size. But it's perfect for London, and you know, we live in an apartment, but we've got the park there. And it's just the best thing that ever happened to her. And I could have never imagined me saying that 18 months ago. And you know what? This will come up in the discussion, I guess, because Toby makes an appearance in the documentary.
That's right.
Which is why I recognize Toby there. But that getting a dog and living with an animal really changed my perspective on me. And now I feel like I'm educated enough to know about production and how it's produced and, you know, the pros and cons of meat in general. But living with an animal completely changed my perspective. I mean, how long have you had a dog yourself?
You know, I grew up with a cat when I was like 10. My sister and I my parents didn't want a cat, and my sister and I were like, screw it, we're getting a cat. We brought a kitten home, and I remember it took like my mom a week to get on board. And then she fell in love with Simba too. We've had Toby and Cooper. So Toby's 6 years old and Cooper's about 2. And I did not want a dog. My now wife, Isabel, wanted one. And I thought, you know, it's going to be so much work. Like, I'm doing all these cool things. And I remember even a couple days after, we're gonna lose some listeners with this comment, but I remember a couple days after being like, we still could find like a really great home for Toby. Like, it doesn't have to be our home. We're gonna make sure this dog is really happy. And then like within a week or two, I was, you know, over the moon, and I got it, and it's completely worth it. But yeah, you know, we abstractly think about animals, non-human animals, as being very different from us. And in some ways they are, of course, but they also have personalities and joys and lows. And, I mean, to me, dogs are very similar to babies. They're very innocent. They're just sort of bundles of joy. And it's our responsibility to be stewards of their life. And, yeah, it's a really, really wonderful experience for anyone who hasn't really bonded with an animal before. But I think a lot of people have, and sometimes it just takes thinking about other animals outside of dogs and cats and extending that kind of generosity to others.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I have my partner to thank as well for getting the dog. So I was dead set against getting a dog. I was like, it's going to be way too much work, and I don't have time, and I'm, you know, and everything else. But you end up working around them, and you make it work. And when you allow that being to come into your life, they can just provide so much joy. Anyway, I could spend the rest of the podcast just chatting about dogs, but we're going to move on. Tell me a bit about your background and where you grew up and stuff. You touch a bit of that in the documentary, which I thought was excellent, by the way. And we'll get to the reasons why. I just think it's such a good documentary, and it's so telling the amount of effort you put into it, and why I think it's better than most documentaries I've seen, and the popular ones that people will have heard of. But tell me a bit about like your background and where you grew up and stuff.
Well, thanks for those comments about Meet Me Halfway. Yeah, really excited about the documentary. I grew up in Staten Island, New York, and for those who know Staten Island, it's sort of it's called the forgotten borough. It's kind of often the joke of New York City. It's not a particularly progressive place. I didn't grow up with a lot of swanky plant-based restaurants around. I didn't know, really, let alone any vegans or vegetarians, really people who didn't go to McDonald's and Burger King and, you know, very, very often. If it was a special treat, my parents would go to Applebee's and Chili's and these, you know, popular chain restaurants in the United States. But one of the parts I really did like growing up in Staten Island was there was a lot of nature. There was a lot of natural spaces and green trails. And as a young kid, that's kind of where I fell in love with the environment and specifically the animals in the wild. I was fascinated by squirrels and raccoons and birds. And so when I got to college, I was your sort of typical card-carrying environmentalist. I would tell people that they should recycle and compost and walk instead of drive and not use plastic bottles and so on. But eventually I made the connection to food. I was actually on my way to present some undergraduate research on climate change with some classmates. And you have to imagine this. I'm genuinely on a plane eating a hamburger. And a friend of mine who I think gave it to me with a sense of sincerity, because he knows I'm interested in these sort of philosophical ideas, gave me this book called The Ethics of What We Eat by Peter Singer and Jim Mason. And that was really the first time that I made the connection to food. It was the first time I realized that many of my food choices weren't aligned with my values, that I was eating food that was not kind to animals and not kind to the environment and certainly not kind to my health. And I'm happy to go into more detail about any of this. But essentially, that was really a light bulb moment for me. And growing up in Staten Island certainly played a key role in shaping my relationship to food.
Yeah. And have you, so I'm assuming you don't, it's clear in the documentary that you are vegan, but is that something that you still practice now? Do you eat vegan? Have you always been a vegan now since then?
I actually wouldn't describe myself as vegan. I would say that I try to be as vegan as possible. I don't worry about the occasional inclusion of animal products in my diet. And, you know, here's really the nuts and bolts of all of this, right? It's like, I don't like factory farming. I'm very concerned about the way we raise animals for food. Very few people like factory farming. You put lots of animals in very small spaces. You know, birds can barely move. Pigs can't walk around. Very cruel conditions. Very destructive to the environment. You have to clear land amidst lots of CO2 emissions, uses a ton of water and other natural resources and so on. And these products are not healthy. I mean, these highly processed foods are not good for people. But most people are not going to go vegan or vegetarian, including my parents, who I love very much. And growing up in Staten Island, very few people I knew in Staten Island would have any shot of thinking they're going to go vegan or vegetarian. And the question I ask myself is, what can we do instead? And my view is what we can do instead is move away from this all or nothing premise that a person is either a vegan or an omnivore. And I take that with respect to my own lifestyle. I do my absolute best to try and eat as many foods that are kind to my body, the planet, and animals. But what's often difficult for people who care a lot about issues is to let go of being perfect and to try to let go of the guilt and the judgment of ourselves and of others. And that's really something that I'm sure I'll continue to struggle with, like, because I'm human, but I do my best. And so I try to eat as many plant-based foods as possible, and that's really my current diet.
You know, my favorite bit in the movie, I think, was in the first 10 minutes when you have a really poignant and authentic conversation with your parents. And like you described, you know, your parents are, I would say, perhaps typical of the Staten Island area. They, you know, you weren't judgmental. It wasn't shaming. And I think there were so many opportunities for someone to act in that way, even if they were trying to be as loving as possible. But, you know, to give some context to the listeners, you mentioned something about avocado toast and they were like, what on earth is avocado toast? And most people listening to this in our echo chamber will also think, what on earth, how do they not know about avocado toast? But that's the majority of people, particularly in America, who have no idea about the impact of factory farming. Or if they do, they don't make the connection between the environmental impact as your parents didn't either. And they question it because they want to continue to do things that are considered quote unquote normal to them. But I thought that was perhaps the most telling bit of the documentary and something that we certainly have to have more of a conversation about. And this is why I love the whole aspect of reducitarianism, for want of a better word, because I think we need to embrace that a lot more.
I really appreciate that. And my dad still feels like a superstar, so I'm going to let him know you were happy with that scene. Reducitarian is anyone, right, who's decided to cut back on the amount of animal products that they consume and kind of letting go of this all or nothing premise. I'm so grateful for my parents, and in many ways, but this way in particular, in the context of this conversation, is that they really ground me. As you say, it's very easy to get lost in our own little bubbles and echo chambers. And it can be frustrating to surround yourself with people who in some ways fundamentally disagree with your major outlooks on life, but it's super useful. And I really encourage people not to block that person on Facebook that has a different view than them, to read news sources, and that are not necessarily exactly in their politics, for example, because it's very useful for thinking about how to go about making change. And my parents, had never had guacamole before. And I wasn't that surprised by this, but my director was shocked. I remember we're at the grocery store, and he's like, we got to make them like this elaborate meal and do something really fun. I was like, dude, they had McDonald's probably right before this. Like, there's no elaborate meal. We're going to scare them off if we throw, this like really complicated salad. We got to go something simple. And I think I just happenstantially picked up this tub of guacamole, and it made for an amazing scene because you can feel the legitimate fear, particularly in my mom, but also my dad, and the anxiety in trying a food that they're not accustomed to, expecting that they're not going to like it, in part because they were right. Their taste buds are so accustomed to highly salted and fatty and sugary foods that they're probably not going to like something that's significantly more whole and natural. And I think it's a shocking scene to a lot of people, but very, very informative and useful in thinking about how we're going to address the systemic issues we have in terms of people's diets. And then, as you said, the cool thing on this is my dad doesn't necessarily care about environmental issues or animals. And this is important to think about, right? Because what message are we going to provide to people? And I wish he did. But he does care about his health. And so what I have found is I try to lean into that message as much as possible with my parents, and maybe for a younger generation who is not necessarily thinking about heart disease at 17, but might be thinking about the climate crisis, you lean into that messaging. So factory farming is so destructive in so many ways that we do have an opportunity to leverage these different points of messaging for different audiences, but it's super interesting to hang out and know people who have a completely different mindset, and we're gonna have to find a way to reach common ground because it's the only way forward, and that's really, as you've implied, an important ethos of the film.
Yeah, definitely. And the reason why I loved it so much is because that mirrors a lot of the conversation that I have with patients one-on-one. So when I work clinically, I'm not seeing the same kind of person that might listen to this podcast or have a genuine interest in nutritional medicine or follow my recipes or buy my cookbooks. I'm having a genuine conversation with someone who's come there, obviously, for a health issue. And different people of different ages have different motivators. And like you said, you leaned into your dad's motivation to be healthy. And I think even at the end of the film, he was like, I didn't even realize how unhealthy I was until I actually started reducing meat. And then I lost all this weight and I feel great now. So, sometimes they don't even know that that's something that they need to do in order to feel better. They don't realize how poorly you feel. But to that point, everyone has different motivators. And I don't think the vegan message, and this is nothing against plant-based individuals or plant-based professionals. We've had a whole bunch on this podcast as well. I don't think that brand is appropriate for the vast majority of people that I come across. So if I was to say, you know, you need to remove all animal products, it's not ethical, it isn't good for the environment, it's not going to be good for future generations, yada, 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 all the points, it will fall on deaf ears and it'll be frustrating for both parties, as it was in some cases for the people that you interviewed, I thought.
I mean, I would go as to say, it's not a question of think. The facts are there. I mean, 1% of the, let's take, you know, 1% of the United States is vegan. Half of those people probably include some amount of animal products in their diet. They were just like me and didn't have a word to describe themselves as someone who occasionally includes animal products in their diet. I mean, one of the things I laugh at every time I think about the film is when my parents are talking about how pizza they think as a health food.
Yeah.
And I'm like, who says this? You know, who told you this? And their reaction is scientists said this. And I'm sure there was, you know, lots of advertising and campaigning. And then it's related to what you do. One of the interviewees talked about how medical professionals and doctors often don't necessarily talk about diet. And I'm sure there are interesting reasons for that. Maybe you have perspective on that. But it's something that I'm grateful for that what you do, because I think that someone has let's say stomach issues and they're eating really unhealthy food. Well, have you tried eating more fiber? But instead, go straight to the medication. But at the same time, someone like my mom, who is very resistant to change, she still hasn't made any changes to her diet. So these are really difficult questions. And by the way, telling someone to eat less meat, as you know from seeing the film, also is a challenging task.
Mm.
Any kind of change is hard. But I agree that asking people to give up all the foods that they love, all the memories, associations, forget that hot dog at the baseball game, no more turkey at the Thanksgiving table. I mean, when you really boil that down on an emotional level, it becomes so obvious how alienating that kind of message can be to a lot of people, which is unfortunate because the vegan message has merit to it in terms of its kindness to animals and its aspirations toward being kinder to the planet and so on. So these are tricky, tricky questions. And that I think comes across on the documentary that there are no simple solutions and that this is really, really challenging. But I'm grateful for people that care and are doing the best that they can with respect to their own choices and encouraging others to make choices that are in line with their values.
Yeah. The Americans are actually a little bit ahead when it comes to teaching nutrition to their medical students. We've had a couple of docs on who talk about the culinary medicine programs at Tulane and Columbia and Harvard Public School of Medicine have got one as well. And we're trying to mimic what they're doing over here in the UK and a couple of universities that we've got a nonprofit in. And I wonder, the documentary, it starts with the scientist who talks about how climate change is irreversible, and it gives me the impression that this is going to be one of those Inconvenient Truth movies where a whole bunch of scientists talk about how the Earth is doomed in the next 10-15 years, and then the message at the end is just go vegan or just do this or just do regenerative farming. But it obviously morphs into something a lot more relatable and a lot more nuanced. I my question when that happened, because I was thinking about it from a film production perspective, did you envisage the documentary looking something quite different to what it ended up looking like prior to starting?
I'm laughing because making a film was one of the hardest things I've ever done. It took, it took 5 years.
Took 5 years. Oh my God.
I'm 32 and I've, when I started doing this work, I was in my early 20s. But I still have no clue what I'm doing. I mean, it's just this kind of, you just figure it out as you go along and you make an ambitious goal. And it's kind of amazing that it can come together. But no, I had no clue what the film was going to be. I said, I want to make a film. I know I want it to be about, getting people to eat less meat. Originally, the film started as this kind of like, I would almost call it like a puff piece. We were going to find people and get them to eat fewer animal products and see what their journey would like and go to grocery stores and the kind of things you've probably seen. And it was going to take a kind of very simple agenda. And what I found as we were going through the experience was that there was no way to tell this story in an honest, truthful way without showing the complexities and the different opinions. And it's funny, I entered this movement feeling really confident. Maybe it was because I was 23 and I thought I had all the answers. And I was very simple. It was like, stop telling people to go vegan, tell them to eat less meat, all the problems will be fixed. Very simple. And I quickly learned that that's not right. It's just not the case. Telling people to do anything is challenging, and there's all these societal forces that, you know, make the default choice often ones that are not in the interest of people or animals and the environment. And so that, thankfully, I had that growth at the right time because we were able to pivot and say, let's really ask a different question here. Why is it so difficult to get people to eat less meat? Let's start there, because every documentary you see is, it's so easy to get people to go vegan. Just, you know, eat more plants and you'll be really fit and healthy and beautiful and all these things. And I know they become very popular, these documentaries, and they certainly resonate with some segment of the population. But I also have I have friends who are from Staten Island who don't see these films and that they don't change their diet, doesn't resonate with them. We entered from that perspective. You know, there's so many things that I didn't expect, right? Like, there's a scene where I go visit pigs that are on their way to slaughter. And I remember telling my director, I really don't want to do this. Like, this sounds awful. It's very outside my comfort zone. And you can see on camera, I'm genuinely uncomfortable because it's a terrible, you know, thing to witness. And even hanging out with, you know, Will, who I think the world of, the farmer in Bluffton, Georgia, such a cool person. What a weird experience for me. Like, I'm a kid from Staten Island. Here I am hanging out in, you know, what feels to me like the middle of nowhere, you know, with this amazing farmer, his awesome accent and these animals on the farm. And so, you know, I benefited a little from being somewhat sheltered because you see an authentic growth in me over time. And that's why the film changed so much over the years, because as I was learning, we were adapting our thinking accordingly. And I still learn new things, but I do feel like, you know, if I had made the film at that 5-year point, it would have been much less informed and much more biased and sort of single issued. And yeah, so that's, but yes, making a film is insane, and it's not for the faint of heart.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. What a revelation that it took 5 years. And it's almost like I can see that journey from in the space of like an hour and 20 minutes, however long it was, because when you watch a typical documentary, the stance is sort of already made up, and then the rest of the film is just there to further and further convince you towards an argument that has already been predetermined. Whereas this one, you didn't really know where it was going, actually, because at the start, it looks like you were pretty ostracized by the vegan community. I'm not too sure if that's still the case. I mean, you do get a lot of stick from people because you don't really ascribe to their sort of rules or their beliefs and stuff, and they believe it's like an attack on their principles. Is that fair to say?
You know, it's tricky. There definitely is a segment of the vegan community that, though extremely well-meaning and in some ways has the, you know, the morality backing them, has a no tolerance for anything that deviates from that kind of message. And there's a scene where briefly where I am protested by some vegan activists, and there's a sign that it says something along the lines of Brian Kateman speaking at an animal rights conference is like Donald Trump speaking at a women's rights conference. So there's a lot baked in there. But I felt like, you know, I'm on your team. You know, there's a whole other group of people who you really take issue with. On the other hand, so many nice vegans, so many welcoming vegans, so many understanding vegans, don't care about purity or just working to make. So it's a, you know, sometimes those loud voices can outshine the more pragmatic ones. But yeah, definitely the reality is everyone has had the experience of meeting one person who shames them for their diet. And I don't know about you, anytime I've been shamed, you know, I just have these like defense mechanisms, and I just psychologically don't necessarily think it works.
I'm lucky in that I don't think I've ever really been truly attacked personally or in real life, if I'm honest. about my thoughts. I mean, I'm plant focused. I've never made any deviation from that over the last, you know, 10 years since I've been taking a further interest in nutrition. You know, I ascribe principles like eating whole foods, eating colorful, eating more fiber, reducing meat and eating quality meat. But my diet is very, very plant-based, around 85-90%. But people do mistake me for being vegan because most of my recipes are vegetarian. And when they find out, it can be, I can understand why it irks them a bit. It's almost like, oh, you tricked me somehow. But I always make it very clear in any of my writing and on the podcast and all that kind of stuff. And my experience probably mimics yours in a lot of ways, in that the vast majority of people that I've met who eat a certain way are very respectful and very tolerant and very understanding, and they choose a different way, and that's totally fine. But there is a minority, and unfortunately those are loud voices that can cloud a lot of the sort of brand of vegan. I actually had a conversation with a good colleague of mine who's a doctor, and I mentioned about how veganism appears to have a bit of a branding problem because of those loud voices. And I think it's unfortunate for the vast majority of people who don't have that sort of aggressive nature, particularly online. But yeah, no, I try to steer clear of any conversations about that, apart from in a podcast where I can speak to someone who's pretty tolerant themselves.
Yeah, no, it's true. And, you know, I think when I think about, look, I come from the place of, in the United States, and you know, similar statistics, I'm sure, in the UK and many other developed nations. In the United States, the average person eats 225 pounds of meat per year. Okay? So this is the most in recorded history. So when I meet someone, let's say like Brian, who's speaking at the moment, who eats a couple of pounds of meat per year, and as you said, 90% of their diet is plant-based, even if I thought the ideal world would be vegan, even if I thought everyone should be vegan, from a limited time and resources perspective, it makes no sense to try to convince you or me to go vegetarian or vegan. We're already very far along. And I think people lose perspective of that, in part because they don't have people like my parents hanging around, where the big wins is to get someone who's eating way too many animal products, indisputably from a health and scientific perspective, from an environmental perspective, and of course, from a moral perspective, to cut back by 10% or 20%. My dad going from 200 pounds of meat a year to 180 pounds of meat a year is huge, because 20 pounds is a lot, because you and I probably don't eat 20 pounds of meat a year. And so it's simply from a strategic perspective, you know, I think I agree that there's too much fixation and obsession with purity. And that's really how this started for me. I hated that I would describe myself as a vegetarian, and I would be in certain social situations, like at Thanksgiving, where my dad is like, just have a damn piece of turkey, Brian. And I pop a, you know, small piece of turkey in my mouth, and my sister, as siblings will do, is, you know, kind of pokes fun at me. You know, hey, Brian, I thought you were vegetarian. Or, you know, I have a friend who leaves a piece of meat on his plate, and the waiter takes the plate away, and I'm like, I really miss eating this, and I pop it in my mouth. And whether or not I should or shouldn't, it's so silly to get caught up in these couple of moments and lose sight of the fact that, you know what, I'm trying. I'm doing I'm doing my best here. Versus a lot of people I'm surrounded by who, for whatever reasons, many of them not entirely their fault, again, because of these systems, are not necessarily trying at all. So there's so much power in reframing the focus from the couple of people, and by percentages, they really are a couple of people who are primarily eating a plant-based diet versus the majority of people who are eating the what I would call the standard American diet. And so,
yeah,
it's tricky stuff, but I think it's a useful framework for thinking about how we can engage and have conversations with the right people. I would never try to persuade you of anything. You're already doing great.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of this, part of Jonathan Safran-Foer's, I think it's his last book, We Are the Weather. He was on the podcast last year, and he almost has like this internal monologue with himself, where he's beating himself up because he had a hamburger at an airport, and he's like, he's meant to be, you know, this whole vegan advocate, and he wrote Eating Animals, and he's convinced a whole bunch of other people to eat a certain way, and he's going, do you know what I mean? So there's this internal monologue, because you try and paint this picture to yourself and other people that you should be pretty puritanical about things. But in reality, when it comes to day-to-day, you know, if you do want to have a piece of meat, you shouldn't be feeling judged around it. And also, it does feed into this phenomena of orthorexia, this unhealthy obsession with healthy eating. And I think certain aspects of diet definitely feed into that negative spiral thinking that can lead to shame, which is, you know, something that we want to try and avoid at all costs, because that certainly over the pandemic is really magnified, and that's been perpetuated, I think, by social media too. So yeah, it's an interesting perspective. Sorry.
No, I totally agree. And, you know, I often say what we put in our mouth is very important, but what comes out of it is also very important. And what I mean by that is, when we're thinking about food, because it's so intimate, because many of us have control over it, we do feel that guilt and shame because we want to live a life that's in line with our values and so on. But, you know, voting for a better politician, or donating money to a charity, or volunteering at an organization, or bringing one vegan meal over to your friend's potluck, that's gonna be so much more impactful, right, than that one hamburger that you had at the airport. And so it's hard because we're human, but trying to keep perspective, I think, of the bigger mission, because it's not just about our own individual bodies. There is, quite frankly, a lot at stake here. One of my favorite lines in the film, Dr. David Katz says, there are no healthy people on an uninhabitable planet. And so, yes, food is personal, but it does involve the exploitation of others and the planet. And so, yeah, I think that is just a helpful reminder that there's also issues at stake outside of our cholesterol levels. This is a combination for people that, you know, maybe are not like my dad, who can entertain some of these other perspectives all at the same time.
yeah, absolutely. I mean, people see me as the food is medicine guy. But I try and remind them through posting the odd, like, you know, jelly babies that I'll eat when I'm working clinically, or like, you know, the warm donut with a jam filling that I think is absolutely amazing. And I'll post that like once a week, just to remind people that it doesn't have to be all or nothing. You can have a bit of balance within the confines of, you know, the general 80-20 rule or something. I did want to ask you about your experience at White Oak, which, for the listeners who haven't seen the documentary, is this incredible farm that looks like the blueprint of how we should be rearing animals for food, for those who want to eat animals. I wonder if you could tell us a bit more of that experience, because that was quite a raw experience, I thought.
Yeah, you know, visiting White Oak Pasture and hanging out with Will,
who had the most amazing accent, by the way. I could only aspire to have an accent like Will. He's just got the incredible southern drawl, which that's amazing.
For like a year after meeting him, I would just occasionally try to bring that out in my conversations with people. But no one can do it justice, because he's that awesome. It was a really, really important and meaningful experience in my life, because it was really the Disney world of farms. I mean, it was entirely sort of authentic and real and not corporatized and so on. But just a person who was very much engaged in a factory farming model that he had inherited from other farmers, you know, in his generation, prior to his generation, and decided that he wanted to reinvent and go back to a simpler kind of farming, one that's more in touch with the land, one that cultivates the soil in ways that it sequesters carbon and increases water capacity, increases organic matter, one that includes animals as part of that regenerative system, but is very kind to them and allows them to express their... And see, like, no language can capture this, right? When I say very kind and I compare it to factory farming, there's no words to divide torture and very kind, right? It's hard for me to articulate this, but the factory farming model is so abusive to animals that when you then go to white oak pastures and you see these animals who, you know, and I told this to Isabel, I was like, you know, in some ways they have better lives than Toby and Cooper. We do the absolute best we can. We take them on three walks. We love them. But these animals have it made really happy. It was so heartening to see. The challenge, right, with this is a couple things. And really just to frame this discussion, what I'm asking now, and if people are not going to cut back on animal products, are there alternatives that we can offer them? And one of these alternatives is meat that doesn't come from a factory farm, that is kind to animals, kind to the planet. It may even taste better and even have, you know, small health benefits. And so the downside, though, is that it's expensive, right? Because factory farming is optimized to, you know, be very cheap. And there's slaughter involved. So there's still going to be the death of a living animal. And now we get into the interesting philosophy because, okay, is it ever okay to kill? Maybe not. But maybe it is because these animals had incredible lives up until that moment. And Will makes this point that, you know, he's seen people die very slowly and gradually. And I'm kind of like one of these right to die people even. I mean, now we're in a whole nother topic, right? But like, I'm into the idea that people shouldn't have to, you know, suffer for 40 years before the end of their life. So things can get kind of odd and philosophical. But at the end of the day, if someone is going to eat meat, this is a whole nother way of engaging with animal products. And I'm really grateful for Will and his kindness and generosity and showing me around. And I even think to myself, just to bring this home, right? Like my wife's parents may be visiting for Thanksgiving and I'm not sure that I can convince them to have this meal be vegan. So I have an opportunity now. Do I let them bring over their, you know, a typical turkey and maybe we'll make it? Or do I pull on what feels like a conflict in my mind, but maybe I order a turkey from Will's farm as a way to balance out those interests. So
yeah,
I think people will love that scene with Will, who's an incredible person, and the farming that he does is just one of the best farms in the world. Really cool stuff.
I am delighted to have the podcast sponsored by Pinterest today. Now, I've been using Pinterest for years in both a personal capacity as well as for my business. So I'm looking forward to telling you a bit about why I think it's a fantastic platform for creative inspiration that you can take action from and how I use it myself. So, personal reasons for using Pinterest. For myself, I've been doing a lot more regular live TV now. And on the pod, I've had a friend of mine talk about slow fashion and the environmental impact of overconsumption. So, over the last few years, I've been consciously trying to reduce my consumption of clothing products and, you know, instead of buying new stuff, trying to think of ways in which to use old outfits and brush them up so I'm still presentable on live TV. But there are some hacks that you can use where I can use clothes that I already have and still stay in fashion. And I use Pinterest for inspiration. When I jump on Pinterest, I can, you know, see what kind of colors are in season right now, how things might look coordinated with different elements of an outfit, whether it be black jeans and a shirt, but, you know, mixing it up with a t-shirt underneath, for example, you know, things that I probably wouldn't have thought of to do myself because I'm not much of a fashionista. And it is still important for me to look relatively presentable when I'm doing live TV. I also use it to better design my kitchen. So I actually shared some boards with my partner that we could collaborate on ideas that brought warmth and personality to where I spend most of my time in the kitchen. And we would look at different color schemes, different ideas from other people who have made their kitchens from scratch. And I've actually since made a kitchen bar where I do all of my filming. I do all my podcasts, including where I'm recording right now. It's where I spend most of my time. And I got a lot of inspiration from Pinterest, looking at the different types of textures, the different stones, all that kind of good stuff I found on Pinterest. It was brilliant. There were a couple of business reasons why I use Pinterest as well. So I'm actually in the process of creating a few other cookbooks and reviewing a number of cookbook cover ideas to see how I can refresh the look of the previous books without really losing the essence of the Doctor's Kitchen brand. And so again, color schemes, seeing what other people have done, how they've used different elements of photography, the design features, all these different things you can find in one place on Pinterest. It's brilliant. And I'm also using it for my new app. So it's a very niche use of Pinterest, I guess, but it's actually helping me design the user flows, the onboarding experience, and the color coordinations for the Doctor's Kitchen brand as well. So if you type in user flows or onboarding in Pinterest, you'll actually get a number of ideas of different apps. And that might be wellness apps, meditation apps, food apps. But the way in which you onboard somebody onto the app is actually quite important. And getting some ideas about how other companies have done this and other apps have done this in the past is absolutely brilliant. Like I said, it's a bit of a niche use of Pinterest, but I guess it just shows you how diverse the content is on the platform and how versatile the use cases are. With Pinterest, I really feel that it's not just a place where you can spend hours and feel like you've wasted time. I actually feel super motivated and inspired when I visit the platform, and it's genuinely helped me in a personal capacity as well as from a business perspective. So go check it out, and you just might surprise yourself. There's a bit in at the start of that scene, once you've got over the fact that he's got this amazing voice, where he talks about his sort of process to where he's become now, where he's, you know, at this holistic farm management system. And he says something like, you know, I used to think a good farm was where you kept the animals, you gave them loads of food, you sheltered them, you didn't poke them or harm them, and then you slaughtered them as quickly as possible. And then he was like, that is like nowhere near enough. And now everything he does, just to bring it home for people who haven't seen it yet, who I recommend everyone watch this, as I'll say in the intro and the outro, but he talks about how he's trying to create the perfect environment for a pig to do exactly what it was designed to do, to running around and graze, and the same thing for all the other different species that they've got on this this farm. And I just thought that was, I mean, to the point where they don't castrate the animals, they don't, you know, pin them, they don't do anything like that. They just allow them to almost live as if they are in the wild. And I thought that was so incredible. Also, you have the ethics of, you know, having to kill the animal afterwards and the way they do that. But the dignity that I think he's giving these animals, I just thought it was incredible. It was a brilliant part.
it was really fun, and I'm grateful for him. And again, you know, whenever we're thinking about these alternatives to factory farming, and I'm sure we'll touch on the others, we're thinking about pros and cons, right? Because yes, there has to be an animal that's slaughtered. But again, it's always worth thinking about like the worst case scenario, which is that 99% of farms in the United States are factory farms. 90% globally are factory farms. So, you know, I'll tell my vegan friends, for example, it makes no sense whatsoever to even spend an ounce of energy critiquing this kind of model in a serious way, because what Will is doing is just incredible. And so I want people to eat more plant-based foods. I really do. I want people to cut back on animal products. But if they're going to eat meat, I would be thrilled if it came from a place like Will's White Oak Pasture. So yeah, it's really, really cool. And even, you know, the fact that he's revived that economy. You know, he's employing so many people in his town. Like, it touches upon this very kind of holistic model that in some ways some of the other alternatives don't. And we'll talk about them, I'm sure. But yeah, it's really, really interesting and cool stuff. And I just told Will, though, off camera, I was like, the problem is you're too cool and amazing. Like, who the heck can do this? I mean, are there really that yeah. many farmers that can? And I, you know, I'm who I am. I don't know a lot of farmers. So I, you know, I don't know how scalable this initiative is. But for whatever it is, it's so cool.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's, you know, something that you bring to light at the end of the movie as well, where you wrap things up, because you visit cell-based meat producers, you meet the, you know, the Beyond Meat guys and all the other people that are creating purely plant-based proteins. But you question everything. It's not like, oh, this is the answer. And there have been some fantastic documentaries that I think are great collectively, because it makes people more conscious about food that they're eating, right? I can definitely get on board with that. But I think where they fall down, particularly amongst the scientific community, is that it is communicated in a way whereby the answer is always just do this and that's fine. Even, you know, the ones that are pro regenerative farming is like, oh, just let's just go for this amazing crop rotation system. It sequesters carbon. It's much better for the environment. You can still eat good quality meat. It has some nutritional benefits over factory farm meat. This is all you need to do. Whereas actually at the end of yours, you're like, well, cell-based meats might actually cost more to the environment, and they definitely cost a lot more money right now. Plant-based proteins still have their own issues with additives and et cetera, et cetera. The regenerative farming model that you saw, the most perfect animal farm, you know, ethics aside, how scalable is that? So you allow the viewer to make up their own mind after watching it. So someone who has a persuasion that still wants to eat meat might do better and might reduce their food intake. Someone who's vegan, you know, questions the quality of the foods that they're currently consuming, and weighs that up against climate change as well, because those are conversations that a lot of people aren't having. So I think that, you know, for some people, I think it'll be frustrating because they just want to know the answer, and we're quite binary humans. I don't know if that was like one of the comments that you've got after showcasing it to people.
I didn't want to interrupt you because I love everything you said. And that's like speaks to my heart. I mean, what you just described is really the core feeling I have right now in life and with this film. It's frustrating, but there really are often no simple answers. And there are pros and cons and different values that are in conflict with one another. And, you know, I know it's not a, you know, political show here, but I also see this with my, you know, I'm liberal, I have some conservative friends, and the many of my smartest friends are not crazy. They're on a different political spectrum, but they actually have similar values to me, and they just have a different method for reaching that utopia. And the more I hang out with people who are different than me, I start to see a kind of possibility of working together. And it's the same thing with food conversations, which can be so charged and so heated. And there are pros and cons to all of these different solutions, and you outlined many of them brilliantly. And I think it is hard because people do want to be told what to do. They don't have a lot of time to spend, like I have 10 years thinking about these complex topics, and they just want to know, you know, I hear you, but it's like Brussels sprouts or kale going to have more antioxidants, or, you know, is it better to eat fish or chicken from an animal welfare perspective? I teach a class, and I'm at a university, and one of the students said, yeah, I hear you, but which is healthier, farmed fish or wild caught fish? And I have to spend 10 minutes explaining that it's complicated. It's not one is healthier or other. There's different components here. So I think it will frustrate some people, but at least it gives people the information and tools that they need to think about this. And the good news, very few people think factory farming is a good idea. Very few people think that we should be eating over 200 pounds of meat a year. Very few people think it's good that, you know, in the United States, for example, 1 out of 10 people get the recommended amounts of fruits and vegetables in their diet. And this is what frustrates me so much. We agree on so much, but we get caught up in these fringe, you know, philosophical, idealistic kinds of conversations about what the future of our food system looks like. Can we just make it a tiny bit better? That would be great to start. And then after that, we can start getting into these really fancy debates. And I feel this way quite frankly about the health community. We just need more people to eat fruits and vegetables. It's really like pretty simple, no? Isn't that the cornerstone of part of the problem is that people are eating way too many processed foods, not whole foods, not enough fruits and vegetables. And there's so many books and discussions and debate. And for the most part, people agree on that. And yet my parents still will not eat a damn avocado. It's like that basic. Sorry, I'm getting heated here.
Yeah, no, it definitely resonates with me. You know, part of my TED talk when we did it a couple of years ago now was painting the picture of nutrition conflicts, whereby 80% roughly, let's say, of all the different dietary regimens actually overlap. So if you have this Venn diagram and you put paleo and vegan and all the rest of it, a lot of the overlapping themes are the same. So instead of fighting about the minority, you should really just focus it down to the principles. And then, you know, the solutions are simple. The science is complex. Implementation is exceptionally hard. So where I'm having conversations with hostel caterers, where I'm having conversations with people in public sector, food environments, you know, creating a landscape where it's easy to opt into a healthy way of eating. That's really the challenge, creating like a salutogenic environment where you can have, you know, if you don't want avocados, you can have like fresh tomatoes, or you can have all the different things. And we actually incentivize that and we subsidize those kind of foods rather than the high fructose corn syrup and all the other additives that we have to process foods right now that are cheap and targeted at the most vulnerable people. So yeah, there's definitely, and I think also, given that the movie was focused on the US, I think there's also a bit of an arrogance amongst the UK residents that this is an American problem and it's not a UK problem. But like you just mentioned there, most of the factories are actually, most of meat is produced from factory farms. Maybe not as bad as the US, but certainly factory farms over here as well that we don't really see or we don't really hear about that much.
Oh yeah, there are plenty of terrible factory farms in the UK. No, they're everywhere and they're growing. And unfortunately, I expect that they will continue to grow as people go through that demographic transition of, you know, rising out of poverty and being able to eat more foods, which in, you know, expensive foods, which is from one perspective is a really good thing. But the factory farming model is not the answer to that. Oh, I had something at the tip of my tongue that I was really excited to respond to you about. I was going to say this. You're smarter than me and you've landed on some probably this much sooner than me, but I thought as like, you just tell people they do things, but it's about this designing the environment, right? So people eat food based on price, on taste and convenience. And so if food is not affordable, delicious and available readily, very few solutions are going to work. And so that's where thinking about these systemic solutions, some of which we've talked about, like, you know, regenerative agriculture or plant-based meat and cell-based meat, and making, you know, affordable fruits and veggies and so on accessible plays a key role. What I struggle with is, you know, getting people to try the foods and then give it a little bit of time, because I know with me, like when I had this ethical realization, I had pasta for like a month because I didn't know that like I could ever eat kale or quinoa or other things. And my wife took me to have Indian food and Thai food for the first time, you know, in my mid-20s. And now it's like, these are my favorite cuisines. So I don't know what your experience is like, but I just, that's a challenge I find is even if you provide these fruits and vegetables and so on for people, it's going to take them time to, I think, allow their taste buds to change. And that's something that Dr. David Katz said off camera, was that it takes a couple weeks and then your taste buds kind of transform. So I don't know if we want to solve all the world's problems on this podcast discussion, but that's another one that I find quite challenging. And I see it in my dad, who now will call me once a week with his kale smoothie that he really, really loves. So like, change is possible, but I'm 32. It took 30 years of stubbornness with my dad to get him to change.
Yeah, definitely. It's certainly true that your taste buds are certainly plastic. They can change, but if you are constantly being hit with dopamine from the sugar that we know, you know, elicits that dopaminergic response. You're going to create a habit around it. Some people call it addicted to food. I know that's quite triggering for people, but it's essentially what's happening. You are becoming dependent on this dopamine hit from sugar and refined foods that are designed to be hyper palatable, calorie rich and unfortunately nutrient poor. So when you take yourself off, quote unquote, those kind of foods and you introduce other foods that are more bitter in terms of their palatability, and taste, there is a transition period that you have to get through. And I think for certain people, getting over that hump could be weeks, it could be a little bit longer. There could be some, you know, challenging symptoms in the meantime as well. It's almost like, you know, we're talking about getting people off certain foods. I'm actually going to be chatting to about food addiction on a podcast with a psychologist soon, actually. But then I guess also my worry, like you just mentioned with the pasta comment, is a lot of impressionable young people are warming towards veganism or plant-based eating because it's cool and they aspire to be like their TikTok stars or their celebrities that have all gone plant-based, who can afford to have a beautiful, well-balanced diet that's made by a nutritionist, that is supplemented with all the right supplements and stuff. Whereas, you know, most people don't have access to that information, can't afford the supplements, and might find themselves on a pretty nutrient poor diet of just like pasta because they don't really have the other options. Or they might go for the, you know, new McDonald's vegan burger, which is, you know, it doesn't have the processed meat, but it's still not great. So that's one of my worries and one of my quandaries around this whole movement towards plant-based eating. Have you been asked about that before?
Yeah, definitely. And I think for a lot of people, the answer for them comes from a place of how cynical or optimistic they are about our ability to transform our food system from a place that is along this axiom of highly pragmatic to highly ideal. And when I think of this person who's no longer eating, you know, processed meats all the time, but now switches to pasta, their health might not be better, but the environmental impact and the animal cruelty component is better versus and you could kind of play these different factors out. And of course, it would be ideal if, you know, that person ate whole plant-based foods and maybe supplemented with some animal products, but wasn't eating pasta or wasn't eating the Beyond Burger all the time. And I think it comes from this question, you know, my dad will have a kale smoothie once in a while, and I'm really excited about that. But he probably would have Beyond Meat a lot because it tastes still relatively salty, still fatty, and so on. It's not equivalent to a health perspective to kale. And so the question is, should I and we ask for more from people and expect more and hope more and push for more? Or should we be happy with settling for something that's great from an environmental perspective, phenomenal on an animal welfare perspective, marginally better maybe from a health perspective? And you might say to me, well, why are you doing this, Brian? Why stop there? Let's do it all. And I say to that, go ahead. Let's push all of these solutions and all these agendas, and let's please try to get more fruits and vegetables in schools and hospital cafeterias, and let's please try to provide, you know, subsidies for fruits and vegetables and all of that. But we don't need to bother attacking plant-based meat companies or cell-based meat companies or people like Will or, you know, so on. It just, we're going to need different people to explore different solutions because nobody has the answer to what is possible. But yeah, these trade-offs are real, and I don't think it makes sense to lie or be anti-scientific about it. Anyone who thinks that Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat is equivalent to a carrot is just being silly. I mean, we know that whole plant-based foods are very, very healthy. And so I don't have the answers because there are no answers. It's tricky.
Yeah. I love the honesty. And I think that's really reflective in the piece of work that you've put out there. And I think it's, I'm excited for people to watch it. What are you up to next? What's next on the reducetarianism journey?
I have two answers to that. One, and it's been wonderful. I've been on like a mini sabbatical. I've never felt so
nice,
light and clear. It's been like 10 years of nonstop. And after the film, I was like close to burnout. And I really, I just wanted to enjoy walking my dogs and being with my wife. And I still, of course, I'm working, I'm doing things, but I'm not pushing as much as I normally am. And it feels great. And it's I'm so happy I'm doing it. And I'm sure I'll wake up one day and be bored out of my mind and ready to be anxious and neurotic and ready to roll with some new venture. But right now I feel a sense of peace, which is really, really cool, in part because the film was so difficult. A couple things. One, Meet Me Halfway, the book is coming out. And it comes out April 22nd on Earth Day, which I'm very excited about. We have our annual summit, our Reducitarian Conference, where we bring together about 750 folks who are very spirited and very passionate and have different ideas, much like we're discussing about how to change our food system, but are open to the idea that we need plurality and different approaches. And we all agree on ending factory farming and so on. And we're going to let go of some of those more philosophical ideas. We're also starting a fellowship program where we're going to have undergraduate students receive mentorship and access to seminars and internships, paid internships, and kind of focus on creating this next generation of advocates and activists. Because as I just mentioned, I'm getting tired. So we're going to have to need to pass it on to the next group of people. So lots of really, really cool things, but just genuinely still in a beautiful moment of feeling gratitude and just joy over the fact that Meet Me Halfway, the documentary, is out and getting to speak to awesome people like you about a topic that I love.
That's epic, man. I can't wait to see everything that happens after this as well. And where can we see it in the UK? I know I went via Vimeo. Is that the main stay of where you can watch it?
I know that it's on Google Play, Vimeo. I'm pretty sure Amazon and Apple TV, if you have that out there, Vimeo, yeah, lots, anywhere you could rent a movie for, you know, $4, it's probably available to you.
Great. You need to get this on Netflix, dude.
I'm working on it.
On it, man. Honestly, it needs to be on Netflix because it's brilliant. It's a lovely, it's not like the antithesis of the documentaries that we've all seen. It's just the most pragmatic, and it's not, you know, it's not offensively vegan. It's not offensively it's just begging the question. I think that's why I'm just such a fan of the movie. So yeah, definitely go watch it.
I really appreciate that. Thank you. This has been such fun, and yes, hopefully the film will make its way onto the next tier of streaming platforms. But we'll make it have a long shelf life for many years to come. And yeah, I really had such a great time chatting with you. Thank you.
I really hope you enjoyed that podcast episode with Brian Capeman. Remember, you can get the movie links and everything that you heard about today on the doctorskitchen.com/podcast page. And these are my personal ways in which to reduce meat consumption while still having almost like a meaty texture whenever you cook. So one of my favorite things to do is oyster mushrooms that you just tear up and then you bake them in soy, garlic, paprika and some sort of molasses, whether it be blackstrap molasses or pomegranate molasses. That combination, baked for about 25 minutes to 30 minutes, turning halfway through, just creates a wonderful meaty texture. And you can put that in tacos, you can put it on top of mash, you can do it just with simple greens. It really works well. Second thing is hemp seeds in shakes. I always add shelled hemp seeds to increase your protein content. It's a good way of making sure that you're not reducing your protein stores, which is very important when it comes to enzymes, cell generation, hormone production, all these different elements that you need protein for beyond just muscle growth. And lastly, pure lentils. So pre-cooked pure lentils
Instead of having a full mince, for example, you can half your mince and have pure lentils if you still want to eat meat, for example, and that way you reduce your meat content, increase your fiber content, and you're not really missing out on the flavor. Anyway, those are my three top tips. There's plenty more ideas of non-meat recipes to reduce your meat consumption if you want to, and I'll see you here next week.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.